ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.
Yes, good morning and welcome to Dads on the Air for the 18th of November 2008. I'm Ian Purdy of ianpurdy.com and I am the sole host of today's program. The other participants send their apologies that they couldn't make it in this morning. So unfortunately for you out there, you've just got me. But I've got a huge show this morning. I'm going to be playing excerpts from the keynote address by Dr. Arnie Rubenstein from the MAN Conference, recorded in Fremantle in August of this year. I've also got an interview with Rudy Oswald, who is part of the Swiss men's movement, and he'll be telling you us all about what's going on over there in Europe and how they are basically dealing with the same problems that we are dealing with over here. Now, there's been a lot of very, very relevant news in the paper lately. The claims in yesterday's Telegraph about a survey that shows that one in four teenagers have witnessed their parents or their fathers being violent to their mothers. Now, Dads on the Air, we dispute these statistics, and we'll be dealing with this issue in full next week, being as how there's only me here today. I haven't had time to prepare, but we're going to get some experts on, and we're going to examine this issue in a lot of detail next week. So stay tuned next week for that one, because we'll be talking about what's going on. Besides that, there's a lot of horrible stuff in the paper. I mean, truck driver pedophiles trying to trade drugs for sex with young indigenous girls. I mean, disgusting. I'm not even going to talk about that. And, of course, the usual ADHD problems. Yesterday's Daily Telegraph, Xanthi Kleinig has written, mother of seven, Alison George, a nurse and naturopath, said ADHD drugs were a quick fix solution. Her son no longer has ADHD symptoms after she reviewed his diet, adding fish oils, removing chemical soaps and washing powders from the house. Now you wouldn't even know that he was an ADHD sufferer, she said. ADHD, you know, you don't have to put kids on drugs. But right next to that article is another article by Janet Fife Yeomans, Generous Drug Giant, ADHD's Boards, Grants and Trips. Janet Fife Yeomans writes, the committee setting guidelines for the treatment of ADHD is dominated by members who have financial connections to drug giants, the Daily Telegraph can reveal. Seven of the 10 group members, including doctors, have declared receiving grants, airfares, hotels, or overseas trips from companies making drugs to treat the disorder. One non-medical member, former teacher Geraldine Moore, had the bill for her book launch picked up by LA Lilly, manufacturer of Strattera, one of the two major ADHD drugs. The committee have warned parents to ignore alternative treatments such as diet and exercise, citing a lack of evidence as to their benefits. Now, to me, that's sus. That's just straight out drug dealing. These people are being bribed by the drug companies to push drugs. Their report comes as the prescription rates for ADHD drugs has soared by 43.4% in the past 12 months to over 390,474 scripts nationwide for all drugs to treat the condition that's ADHD. Group Chairman, pediatrician Dr. David Forbes said yesterday that accepting funds from drug companies was a reality of modern medicine. So there you go. The fact that they get bribed by the pushers to shove their products on our children is completely acceptable, they tell us. And of course, the result of this all these ADHD children we've got out there is a community which is riddled with lots more problems than we used to have before we had these. Getting another further to this issue, also in yesterday's Telegraphs, residents tell food giant to burger off. Justin Vallejo writes, in defiance of the global credit crisis, McDonald's will open 55 new sites across Australia by the end of 2009. Oh, hallelujah. I mean, McDonald's foods, anyone who listens to this program, who listens to me and my other programs, will know that I oppose McDonald's. I don't think they serve food. I think they serve up something that lawyers can't prove is not food. If you were to take a Big Mac and leave it somewhere in a paddock, come back 2 years later, it'll still be there. It won't have rotted. Nothing else will have eaten it. All the animals and wildlife out there know it's not food. Unfortunately, we've all been hoodwinked by advertising campaigns and to thinking that their garbage is actually edible and is something that is okay to put in your mouth. Let me go on with this article Justin Vallejo has written. In the past 10 years, McDonald's has been run out of town in Katoomba, had two previous applications for a site in Camden rejected by the local council most recently last year, while Camden, Picton and Dubbo are just beginning their fight against McDonald's. Residents of Mossvale have had an early win, with Whinjakarabee Shire Council rejecting a proposal for a new outlet. McDonald's has vowed to try again. By the end of next year, there will be new stores open in Taree, Timmott, Leeton, Wagga Wagga, Grafton, Scone, Morissette and Glen Innes, where they will knock down and replace the heritage-listed Roxy Theatre. Well, isn't that great? They're going to knock down a heritage-listed theatre to build a McDonald's. Great. Now, we all know that the value of nutrition, especially for children, and a lack of nutrition in those last articles has been linked with the condition ADHD. And, of course, in this morning's Telegraph, Vandals Trash Our Lives, Calvin Bishop and Justin Vallejo again write, youths and drunken louts are trashing New South Wales at a record rate, with graffiti or vandalism being reported to police every 5 minutes. Malicious damage incidents have climbed sharply as other crimes are falling, leaving councils and state government agencies with an estimated $200 million cleanup bill last year. The article goes on to say, Bureau of Crime Statistics and Research Director Don Weatherburn said the malicious damage problem was much bigger than the police figures suggest. When we survey people, the malicious damage problem comes up as their number one crime concern alongside robbery due to its direct and immediate impact on their lives. Now, this is young people in the community, you know, what can I say? You link all these things together and you kind of get the picture that things are going horribly wrong in our 21st century parenting practices. You know, diet obviously plays a huge part in these problems, as does a lack of fathering, a lack of strong role models. These are creating problems for children. Basically, our children are being ripped off. They're being robbed of the chance to lead rewarding, fulfilled lives, by getting a really bad start in life. I won't even go into the foster care situation where they're even more drugged than the rest of the population. You know, those poor little kids that go into foster care, taken away from their families. That, oh, look, there's an editorial in The Australian. I suggest you grab a copy of today's Australian and have a look at what's going on in our society with these poor children who are disadvantaged from the word go and basically just cop a real bum rap from the world that gets worse and worse and worse as they grow into a life of drug addiction, of not fitting in, of unemployment, of basic and mental problems, you name it, homelessness. All the problems in our society all come from a lack of a decent home, a decent family background, a lack of strong male and female role models, a mother and a father on the job giving the children the love, the nutrition, and the guidance that they need to grow to be healthy, responsible, contributing members of our society. So this is where we are going wrong, people. All right, on a happy note, it's not all doom and gloom. I have got a new song from Horizon Shine. Horizon Shine have been producing music, songs, exclusively for Dads on the Air. Four of their songs are available as free downloads from our website. That's dadsontheair.net for anybody out there who doesn't know. So if you want to download the Horizon, four of the songs are there. Horizon Shine have now recorded six songs, and I am about to play the sixth song, which is hot off the press. This is a world first, an exclusive world premiere of the latest Horizon Shine song. It's called Goulburn Street Hall. It's actually about the family court, which is in Goulburn Street in Sydney. Anybody who knows about Goulburn Street Hall, who's been there, who's been dragged over the coals in there, who's gone in there and had their family callously butchered by an uncaring judicial system, will know exactly the sentiments behind this song. We're not expecting you to enjoy it. We just hope it doesn't make anybody out there feel like they need to vomit. So this is the latest offering from Horizon Shine. This is Goulburn Street Hall, a world exclusive. You heard it first on Dad's on the Air.
Innocent families, lambs to the slaughter. They separate brother and mother and daughter. all to our home, lost in the horror of Golden Street Hall. Golden Street Hall, where love has to crawl.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air. Dr. Arnie Rubenstein is the co-founder and CEO of the Pathways Foundation, a not-for-profit organisation that runs the national award-winning Pathways to Manhood program in schools and communities around Australia. This program for teenage boys and their fathers is a contemporary rite of passage that aims to inspire the boys to have a vision and reach their potential. Arna has studied global rites of passage and has been a guest speaker at seminars and conferences all around Australia. Dr. Rubenstein worked as a general practitioner from 1992 to 2002, specialising in adolescent health and preventative medicine. At the Men's Advisory Network's second national conference back in August in Fremantle, we recorded Dr. Rubenstein's inspiring keynote address titled Creating Contemporary Rites of Passage and the Pathways to Manhood Program.
So I'd like to start off a little bit with my story. I graduated as a doctor in 1989 and worked for 12 years in general practice and accident emergency departments in different places around Australia. It was a very formative time in my life. About 6 months after I graduated, my first child, Jarrah, was born, and then 2 years later, his younger brother, Jaden, was born. And when this photo was taken, they could both fit easily into a small cardboard box, believe it was a car, and have a fantastic time. About the same time as this photo was taken, my young Canadian wife decided that she'd had enough of Australia and I guess enough of me as well, and went back to Canada, which left me a single father with a 1 and a 3-year-old boy. It was a very difficult time in my life, but it was also one of, if not the most rewarding time for me, and probably had more impact on me as a person than anything else has so far. My boys developed into beautiful young boys, and they now tower over me, being 6'4" and 6'1" respectively. And in fact, the last time we all went in a car together and had to sit in the back, they said that I should sit in the middle because I was the smallest. I'm talking today about rites of passage and rites of passage specifically for boys, whether we can create them and how we do it in the organisation that I work for. So what I really am going to try and cover this morning with regards to rites of passage is, you know, what is a rite of passage? Why should we even bother creating rites of passage in Australia today? And can we in fact do it? Is it something that's even possible to do? Just before I get into that, in that same period of time after I became a single dad looking after my boys in the early 90s, I actually went along to a men's gathering. It was the first time I'd ever been to something like that, and I remember driving out to this gathering where I knew there was going to be about 60, 80 men, and I was thinking, well, I kind of have an idea what my issues are. I'll be very interested to see what the issues of all the other men are. And what I was amazed to find was that all of us had pretty similar issues, and all of us had all or some of the following issues. And the first was not having been acknowledged by our own fathers. I discovered that there's a huge wound out there that not only I have, but a lot of men have around the relationship that we had with our fathers when we were younger, and that that has impacted on us for our whole lives. I found that relationships is a major issue, whether it's with women, whether it's with men, partners, however it is, how to have a genuinely healthy relationship, not one that's based on our wounds and our needs and our problems, but as men, how many of us can honestly say we have really genuinely healthy, appropriate relationships going on? And I certainly couldn't at that stage, and it's something I'm very much still working on. The other issues were around how to bring up our own kids. You know, how do we be fathers? What's the best way to deal with our children as they grow up, when they're young, as they start to challenge us, all of those sorts of things? Another very big one is, what is our true mission in life? You know, are we doing what we really feel we are here on this earth to do? Or are we just doing what we're doing because it's what we did yesterday and what we did last week, and it happens to be the train that we're on? In fact, I came to the conclusion that very many men, myself included, were on a train going this way, and the train we really wanted to be on was the train going that way. And to get from this train to that train seemed too scary. And so many of us were staying on the wrong train. And the final one is a sort of a random thing, and that is the things that happened to us when we were children and teenagers that we never dealt with. And they may be abuse, they may be first love that sort of got trampled on. I remember as a teenager, when I would fall in love overnight with a girl, I would offer my entire heart on a platter, here, take the whole thing. And a few times it sort of got tipped off onto the ground and stepped on and, you know, kicked to the side. So I very quickly put up a whole heap of defence mechanisms until I got to the point where in my later years a relationship would mean, here's a tiny little bit of my heart on loan, and if you deal with it really well, maybe I'll consider it, but otherwise I'll take it back very quickly. So there was issues with relationships, issues with abuse, issues with all sorts of different things that happened to us when we were growing up. But the common factor was that most of us hadn't really dealt with that stuff, and any attempts we had made to deal with it had been done on our own. And in fact, all of these issues that happened to us growing up and as teenagers seemed to be very much impacting on us as men, even though we were in our 30s and 40s. And it was at that time, as a result of those gatherings, that we started talking about rites of passage. So first of all, if I define a rite of passage is a process that marks a point, a transition in life. So we actually have in our society many, many rites of passage. So a marriage, a wedding is a rite of passage. A graduation is a rite of passage. A birthday is a rite of passage. And what we do is we celebrate it. We tend to dress up in unusual clothes. Often the holy man of the community will come out. You know, we may do it in a special place, whatever. And then on the other side of the rite of passage, we're different. And we are publicly recognised as being different. So we may be married, or we may be now, I was a doctor where before I was a student. We may be, you know, 8 years old instead of 7 year old. Whatever it is, a funeral is a rite of passage. You know, all of these things we have through our society commonly that mark a transition point in our life. The key rite of passage that we no longer seem to formally have, and the one that I actually believe is for a man the most important rite of passage of all, is the safe, supported, and acknowledged journey that marks our transition from boy to man. And in the Indigenous societies and communities where they placed so much importance on rites of passage, this was the one that had the most effort put into it, and that was seen as the one that you just could not not do. And we don't anymore. So when I worked as a general practitioner, I was quite amazed to see that, you know, I was getting fantastic 8, 9, 10, 11-year-old kids coming into my surgery. I mean, I believe that in Australia, overall, not everywhere, but overall, we give our kids a fantastic start. They all basically have access to school. They hopefully all get fed. They have PlayStations, and they have, you know, little computer games they put in their pockets, and now they have mobile phones, and they have social groups, and, you know, I think that overall, we give our kids a fantastic start. However, I was seeing time and time again those same kids at 14, 15 and 16 years of age, or their older brothers or other kids in the community, and it was a very different picture. We wrote in Australia last year 124,000 scripts for antidepressants for teenagers. 124,000 antidepressant scripts for medication for teenagers were written in 2007 in Australia. What is going on when at epidemic proportions we are medicating our teenagers to get through the day? We have the highest rate of youth suicide in the Western world. We have a major issue with drugs. You know, I have a 16 and an 18 year old son. They are right in that target field. And I say to parents when I give these talks all over Australia, the question that we need to be asking ourselves is not how can we keep our kids away from drugs. And also I need to say that the drug situation is very different today than it was when we were kids. When I was a teenager, there was a bit of marijuana around, maybe, whatever. It wasn't hydroponically grown, and, you know, it was just there. But today, the issue with the amphetamines, ice, ecstasy, etc., etc., is major and is a part of life. And we cannot be asking ourselves how we're going to keep our kids away from those drugs, because we can't. They are part of the culture. The question we need to be asking ourselves is what is going to make the difference between whether our kids say yes or no when the drugs are on offer. And in fact, it even goes a step further than that, because we probably all need to accept that our kids are all going to try drugs and they are all going to get drunk. Is there any person in this room who, when they were a teenager, never did anything that they knew was wrong or beyond the boundaries of what their parents would have been happy for them to do? Because I'm actually doing a national survey and I haven't been able to find anyone yet.
We'll be back with more of Dr. Arnie Rubenstein after this short break.
Getting better, but nobody's really sure. And short arrow straight, straight as a line. All the gays are macho, can't you see the leather shine? You don't wanna sound dumb, don't want to offend, so don't call me a faggot, not unless you are a friend. Then if you're tall and handsome and strong, you can wear the uniform and I could play along. And so it goes, go round again, but now and then we wonder who the real men are. Whoa, oh, 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 time to get scared, time to change plan. Don't know how to treat a lady, don't know how to be a man. Time to admit what you call defeat, cause there's women running past you now and you just drag your feet. Man makes a gun, man goes to war, man can kill and man can drink and man can take a whore. Kill all the blacks, kill all the reds, and if there's war between the sexes then there'll be no people left. And so it goes, go round again, but now and then we wonder who the real men are. Whoa, oh, whoa, 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 whoa.
Welcome back. You're listening to Dr. Arnie Rubenstein, recorded at the Men's Advisory Network Second National Conference.
So we actually need to accept that stepping over the boundaries, etc., etc., is a normal part of development. But the question is, once again, why are some kids going to make it part of their life and be basically, you know, at huge risk of being majorly affected by it, and why are other kids going to go, nah, I'm not interested, or I've tried that, but I've got something else I want to do with my life. I've got a lot of other things I want to do with my life. So we really looked into that, and for me as a doctor, I became increasingly frustrated that the majority of patients who I was seeing were my age or older, and that I was very much having to deal with the results of their lifestyles and their addictions. And that in Australia we put 98 cents of our health dollar into curative medicine and we put 2 cents of our dollar into preventative medicine. And that just seems kind of obviously wrong to me. And I dealt in all sorts of different areas. I did a lot of work in accident and emergency departments. I did a lot of work with drug and alcohol rehabilitation. I ran drug prevention programs. All sorts of different things. And when I really thought about it, I had some fundamental issues with the medical system in Australia. I think it's very sad what's happened, and I won't go into that. But when I thought about where could I have the most impact, what was the sort of the most critical and crucial period that I could work on? And it's not saying that there's only one area. I mean, every area needs to be worked on. But in the area that I felt most drawn to and I felt that I could have most impact, I definitely felt that it was with teenagers. And with teenagers in early puberty, because I'm working on the theory that we're giving our kids a good start, and if we can get them through that period of early puberty, well, actually one of two things is going to happen at that point. They're either going to get, as teenagers, they're going to be motivated and, you know, thinking about how much they can do in life and all the opportunities that they have, or they're going to start going off the rails. And unfortunately today, if you go off the rails as a teenager, it's becoming harder and harder to get back on the rails, or whatever you want to express it as. And that if you're getting into trouble with drugs and alcohol as a teenager, or if you're dropping out of the system and not able to get an education, all of those things have a major impact. And in fact, I could see that in my medical practice, so much of what I was dealing with was the result of addictions with men, whether it was alcohol, cigarettes, overwork, stress, unhealthy relationships, whatever, that I was dealing with that end of the spectrum, and that so many of those things actually started with those men when they were teenagers and hadn't been dealt with. And we're still dealing with the results at 50, 60 and 70 years of age. So the logical thing was, if we could, you know, do the work at the teenage level, that we could actually have social impact that would affect society long term to a much greater degree. And so then it was like, okay, well, what makes the most difference as to how well a teenager is going to function? And really what it came down to is that self-esteem, or healthy self-esteem, is the key. And by healthy self-esteem, I mean feeling like you have some sort of control over your life, so that you've got, you know, you can influence what happens. Feeling confident to have a go and try things, and being socialized and supported. So that if you feel like you've got some sort of control, if you feel like you can have a go, and you feel like you've got a family and social system that supports you, you're going to have high self-esteem. The opposite of that, and unfortunately the easier way to demonstrate the impact of self-esteem, is to talk about low self-esteem. So a kid who has low self-esteem is going to feel like he's a victim, he can't affect anything, so he's, you know, everything happens to me. He's going to feel like he can't have a go because he's just going to fail. He fails every time. And he's also going to feel unsupported. No one loves me and no one cares. And guess what? Those kids, if I feel like I'm a victim, if I feel like I can't have a go because I'm just going to fail, and if I feel like nobody loves me, I've got a problem. And I'm going to have low self-esteem. And it's interesting, if we come in and we look at this whole thing that I mentioned earlier around drugs. If I've got high self-esteem, if I feel like I've got some level of control, I'm thinking about what I want to do in the future, I'm confident to have a go and I feel supported, I'm going to be thinking about what I want to do with my life, what sort of career I want to have, what sort of house, car, where I want to travel, all those sorts of things. Someone comes along and offers me drugs, I'm much greater chance of saying no. Or I might try them, but I can see the damage they do, and I don't, it's not a lifestyle that I want to choose. If I'm a kid who feels lousy about myself, I've got no power, no one loves me, no one cares about me, someone comes along and gives me drugs, guess how I feel when I'm stoned? I feel great. I feel powerful. I feel alive. I feel like I can, you know, I've got that sense of euphoria. And not only that, the group I'm with is going to accept me. Okay, they may only be accepting me because I'm taking drugs, but at least someone's accepting me. And then I get straight again and I feel lousy again. So what do I want to do? I want to take drugs again, or get drunk, or do stupid things with this peer group who are looking for trouble because they accept me. So when my self-esteem gets tied up in drugs, alcohol, or an unhealthy peer group, that's when I've really got a problem. What we then looked into is around, okay, so if we think a rite of passage is important, and we know that every Indigenous society and community always did rites of passage, and interestingly, they did them all over the world, they all did them at the same age when boys reached puberty, and they all basically did the same things. It was done in different ways, but the elements were the same. But, you know, what were they trying to achieve by doing these rites of passage? And what we found was that they were actually looking to create a shift from the way a boy thinks and functions to the way a man thinks and functions. So this is the theory around a rite of passage, that men start off as boys, and that's fine and that's appropriate. And as a boy, we have what we call boy psychology. But what we need to do is create a shift to healthy man psychology. And by the way, I didn't go through a rite of passage at that age. So boy psychology, we would say, is all about seeking acknowledgement. It's all about look at me, watch me, see me. Everything I do as a 6 or 7 year old is so that someone can see me. And it's 10 times better if I'm being watched by my mother, my father, and as many people as possible. And we say that's normal for a 6 or 7 year old boy, but it's very inappropriate for a grown man. And healthy man psychology, we talk about as being having a mission. So we actually do what we do because we believe in it. It actually doesn't matter whether we're seen or not, it's the right thing to do. Boy psychology is all about power, and power being for me, where healthy man psychology is about sharing power, doing good in your community, doing good for those around you rather than just keeping all the power for you. Boy psychology is we think that we're the centre of the universe. And it's understandable why a seven-year-old thinks they're the centre of the universe, because they get everything. They get woken up in the morning, they get given breakfast, they get driven to school, there's lunch in their bag, they get picked up, they get given dinner, bath, dried, put to bed, read a story, given a kiss, the light gets turned off. In a lot of cases, not in every case, but in a lot of cases. As men, we need to understand that we're part of the universe, and the universe extends infinitely in every direction. A boy thinks he's going to live forever, which is fantastic and appropriate. As men, hopefully we actually understand that we're mortal, and it affects how we live our lives and the actions that we take. A boy is ruled by his emotions. If he doesn't get what he wants, he has a temper tantrum. If a man has a temper tantrum because he doesn't get what he wants, that's actually domestic violence. Whether it's physical or verbal, it's not okay. So as men, we actually have to be able to stand with our emotions. A boy takes no responsibility for his actions, but hopefully a healthy man is able to take full responsibility. We need to be responsible for our actions. And finally, a boy is looking for a mother, which is beautiful for a boy. But if you ask any of the women in the room if they want a man who's still looking for a mother, and we know that over 50% of marriages are ending in divorce in Australia, and the majority of those are being initiated by women now, and we would say that a healthy man actually seeks genuine relationship with the feminine. And the Indigenous societies and communities recognise this, and they recognise it for a number of reasons. They recognise that if the boys were going to be the future leaders in their community, if it was based on boy psychology, which is it's all about me and I want all the power, and you know, if the earth is the sort of the mother energy and I'm a boy, well, then I feel I can just take and take and take, they recognised that their community was not going to be sustainable. Whereas if we actually have men who do what they do because they believe it's the right thing, share power, you know, take responsibility and actually seek relationship with the environment, it would be very different. Another thing is, you know, I ask parents, you know, what do they want for their kids when they're grown up? And very often I hear that they want their kids to be successful. And I say, okay, well, if we base success on boy psychology, a successful boy is going to be incredibly wealthy, have an incredibly big house with a huge fence around it, is going to have lots of cars, is going to have, you know, big swimming pools, is going to have, you know, multiple women, etc., etc. That is boy psychology definition of success that we actually see on television and through the media all the time. Imagine if we actually defined success from a place of healthy man psychology, then we would honour the men who were home every night for dinner. We would honour the men who did community work. We would honour the men who had long-standing healthy relationships with their wives and children. It would be very, very different. And I believe would be a lot healthier. And I believe that's why they did rites of passage. Because this shift is such a fundamental shift. And I didn't go through it, and we're not going through it routinely in our society. And I believe that we have a lot of boy psychology going on and that it's creating huge problems.
We'll be back with more after this track.
The road is long, with a many a winding tongue that leads us to who knows where, who knows where. But I'm strong. So on we go. brother. It's a long, long road from which there is no return. While we're on the way to there, why not share?
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air. You're listening to Dr. Arnie Rubenstein talking about creating contemporary rites of passage.
How can we actually create rites of passage today? What would we do given the society that we live in? And what we found from our research was that all of these Indigenous societies and communities that all had a rite of passage all basically did the same thing, in different ways, but they did the same thing. So we looked at what were those common elements and how we could bring them into a modern context. The first thing that they all did was that they all did it at the same age. So they all did it when their boys reached puberty, and it involved taking the boys away for a period of time and spending time with them. So in the organisation that I work in, the Pathways Foundation, we run camps where we take fathers and sons, or if it's not the father, the boy can come with a grandfather, an uncle or a mentor, and we go out in the bush for 5 or 6 days at a time, and we say no watches, no mobile phones, no reading material, no work stuff, no electronics, just a boy and a dad or a man out in the bush for 5 or 6 days together. We can only deliver our programs to about 1,000 families this year, so I think it's important that we also recognise that there are other ways that we can do this. And the principle of what I'm saying is that when our boys are at that age, we need to spend time with them. We need to dedicate time to them. And we need to do it without our mobile phones and without other distractions. The mobile phone is an interesting thing. I mentioned it in my talk last night. My boys, my sons, hate my mobile phone. They love it because it's an iPhone and they can play with it, but they hate that it rings. Because what happens is when my phone rings, if I answer my phone, what I'm subconsciously saying to my sons is, whoever is on the other end of this phone is more important than you. And that's a major message. Because the other thing that I didn't talk about earlier is that in terms of self-esteem, the number one place that a boy gets his self-esteem from is not what footy team he's in, it's not how well he does at school, it's the relationship that he has with his father. The better the relationship a boy has with his father is the major prognostic indicator of his self-esteem. And I've done lots of work with the juvenile justice system and men from prison and all those sorts of things. And I ask them, you know, what sort of relationship did you have with your dad when you were growing up? And I hear disaster story after disaster story after disaster story. And you wonder why young men and young adults are angry and doing these things. And then you hear what's actually happened to them, and all of a sudden it becomes a lot more obvious. So the first thing I'm saying is that vital for young teenagers is that we spend time with them and we spend uninterrupted time with them. And that may mean actually committing to an evening a week or a day a month or a weekend every 2 months or whatever it is that works for you, where you say, I'm going to put aside this time, I'm going to mark it off in my diary, I'm going to do nothing else except be 100% present with my son. And we can all do that. The second thing that always happened in these Indigenous societies and communities was that they shared the story of their community with their boys when they took them away. Some would do it through songs, some would do it through dances, paintings in caves, whatever. We do it on our programs by sitting in a circle, man, boy, man, boy, man, boy. We have a fire in the middle, and we ask the men to tell a story. They're not allowed to lecture or philosophize, because boys aren't interested in hearing men lecturing and philosophizing, in case you hadn't worked that out already. But they love hearing our stories. So we'll say to the men, you know, tell us a story about how it was for you when you were the age that your boy is now. And how is your relationship with your father? Which is a huge story for a lot of men. Huge. We ask the men to talk about their greatest successes and their greatest failures. Women, you know, the events that had the most impact on their lives. And the boys sit there and their eyes are like this, listening to all this huge range of stories. You know, one of the interesting things we find is that most of the young teenage boys are struggling, and most of them think they're the only ones who are struggling. And then when they hear all these men talk about the difficulties that they went through, and they go, oh, maybe I'm okay. And also, by hearing those stories, they get to decide how they want to be when they're men. And we believe that that's the best teaching modality for the boys. And also, it connects them in. It makes them realize it's not just about me now, that the story of who I am started a long time before I was born and will go a long time after me. Which very much ties into becoming part of a community, understanding that you're part of the universe rather than the center of the universe, etc., etc. Once again, we can't all necessarily go on a formal program, but we can share our stories with our boys. When they're growing up, we give them the censored version of our story. My 7-year-old doesn't need to know that I used to go out and get drunk and, you know, vomit and look for, you know, whatever trouble I could get into, or etc., etc. But when he's 13 or 14, it's really good that he does know. And it's really good to know where I did get in trouble and the impact that had on my life, etc., etc. So boys want to know our stories, and I believe we have an obligation to tell them. The next thing is a challenge. Always on a rite of passage, the boys were given a challenge. In some communities, they had to go out and kill a wild animal. In others, they had to spend long periods of time on their own. In some communities, they had to jump off a big tower with a vine around their ankle, whatever. But they all did something that made the boys feel like a man and made them face their mortality. You know, it's interesting, because in the community, sometimes they'd send out, you know, 20 boys and they'd only get 15 back. We can't do that in our programs. You know, we actually have to be very serious about our occupational health and safety, and we have to be very serious about our child protection, because they are the two greatest threats to our organisation. But we also have an obligation to create challenges that seem difficult to the boys and to get them doing things that they didn't think they would have been able to do. Because guess what happens if we don't? They go and do it themselves. That's why these kids are stealing cars. That's why they're driving at 200 kilometres an hour down dirt roads with the lights off. That's why they're doing drag races. That's why they're train surfing. That's why they're looking for fights. They're actually trying to self-initiate. They're trying to do things that will make them feel like a man. And we're losing kids on the way. There are 5 crosses being put up on the road within 3 kilometres of the town where I live in New South Wales. 5 crosses in the last 18 months. All boys, all under 25 years of age. We're losing our kids. So we believe that we actually, as men in our community, have an obligation to be creating appropriate facilitator challenges for our boys. And this can either be done on a program, or we can think, what are things that we can do? How can we actually give our kids more responsibility? What are things that we can do that actually show them that we see them as men and that allow them to push their limits, but without being, you know, ridiculously dangerous and creating problems? And I believe that that is also a very doable thing.
We'll be back with more of Dr. Rubenstein's keynote address very shortly. Welcome back. You're listening to the final part of Dr. Arne Rubenstein's inspiring keynote address at the MAN Second National Conference in Fremantle.
The third thing that always happened on a rite of passage, which I think is really interesting, is this concept of introduction to spirit. And this is where we maybe get a little bit controversial. In an Indigenous society, often when a mother was pregnant, or when someone would have a dream, or the mother would have a dream, or something would happen to the child while he was growing up, and someone would say, that shows us the spirit of this boy. And when he went through his rite of passage, that would be acknowledged and painted on him, or tattooed on him, or marked on him in some way. And then that boy or young man would then take on that spirit and would live the rest of his life in his community as that spirit. Spirituality and spirit was a way of living. as opposed to what we do, where we might practice our spirituality for an hour or two on Sunday morning or for 20 minutes after dinner or whatever it is, it's very different. And in the indigenous societies, by having that association with their particular spirit, it gave them a place in their community. It gave them recognition and it gave them a place. Now, how do we do that? Because we can't have dreams about kids when they're pregnant and, you know, mums are pregnant, etc., etc. But what we do in our programs is that after we've been out in the bush for a week with these kids, at the end, we actually build, like, we have a special chair or whatever, and one at a time the boy comes and sits on the chair, and then in front of everyone, his father comes up and he acknowledges his son and honours publicly his son for all the things that he loves about him and all the gifts and special talents that he sees that he has. And he does this in front of all the other men and the boys. Imagine, you're 12, 13 years of age, you're out in the bush, you're being there with your dad, your dad's taken a week off work for the first time ever, spent a whole week just with you, and here you are being publicly honoured by your father in front of all these other men and boys your own age. And after the father's done it, one of the other men does it, and one of the leaders do it, people who've been watching this boy for the whole week. It has a massive impact on the boy. And what are we actually doing when we do that? First of all, we're having a huge impact on his self-esteem. If self-esteem is the most important thing, if the number one place it comes from is a relationship with your father, and you then get publicly honoured by your father in front of everyone else, that has a huge impact on your self-esteem. Massive. But the other thing that it does is when we are acknowledging the gifts and talents that this boy has, we're actually saying, these gifts and talents that we see you have, this is your spirit. And this is who we want you to be. If you're wonderful at music, we want to acknowledge that and we want to encourage you to be a musician. If you're great at sport, if you're great at art, if you're great at whatever, we see you and we want you to be that person. Now, what are we doing in modern society today with our incredibly sophisticated marketing and advertising campaigns? And by the way, the marketers and the advertisers have better and more research on social trends than any other group in society. And what they're doing is using all of that stuff to try and create the perfect advertising campaign which can get every single boy to wear the same clothes, listen to the same music, eat the same food and do the same things. So in a nutshell, in the name of consumerism, what we're trying to do is get every kid to be the same. And what we're saying is that is exactly the wrong thing to do. That we actually need to get every kid being who he is so that we have the whole spectrum, that we need musicians, we need artists, we need builders, we need sportsmen. But if we're trying to force the artists to be the builders, and if we're trying to force the musicians to be the gardeners, and if we're trying to, you know, whatever, I believe that creates enormous problems. If I'm, you know, artistic and musical and sensitive, and society's telling me, nah, the only way you can be a man is if you play footy, drink lots of beer and get lots of girls, it's like, I want to be on this train, society's telling me I've got to be on that train, no one is seeing me for who I am. I believe that the difference, the angle between who we really are and our ability to do that, as opposed to what we're actually doing, that the greater that difference is the depression factor. And we're writing 124,000 scripts for antidepressants every year. And I believe the greatest gift that we can give a young man is to recognize and acknowledge the spirit that is in him and to encourage that spirit to come out and tell him he is wonderful for being exactly who he is. Not who society thinks he should be, not even who his parents or the community thinks he should be, but who he actually is. And we can do that on our programs, but we can also do it in life. We can do it just by really taking that time and effort to see and acknowledge our boys and to encourage them towards their natural gifts rather than having expectations that they should be who we think they should be. I believe that rites of passage are vital. I believe that we can create them. There's a huge interest in rites of passage happening at the moment, not only in Australia but around the world. They're actually having the first international conference on rites of passage happening in October this year in Hawaii, where there'll be people coming from all over the world. I believe it's a very doable thing. I believe that there's a lot of common sense, and my hope is that if we can really make rites of passage, and by the way, not only just for boys, but also for girls, a normal part of society, that we can have enormous impact not only on the lives of those children, but also within the societies that they will function and live in as they grow older.
If you'd like to find out more about the Pathways Foundation and contemporary rites of passage for Australian boys and girls, go to pathwaysfoundation.com.au, or you can call a toll-free number 1300 850 766.
It's not time to make a change. Just relax, take it easy. You're still young, that's your fault. There's so much you have to know. Find a girl, settle down. If you want, you can marry. Look at me, I am old, but I'm happy. I was once like you are now, and I know that it's not easy to be calm when you found something going on. Take your time, think a lot, think of everything you've got, for you will still be here tomorrow, but your dreams may not. Turns away again. It's always been the same, same old story. From the moment I could talk, I was ordered to listen. Now there's a way, and I know that I have to go away. I know I have to go. It's not time to make a change. Just sit down and take it slowly. You're still young, that's your fault. There's so much you have to go through. Find a girl, I'll settle down. So if you want, you can marry. Look at me, I am old, but I'm happy. All the times that I've cried, keeping all the things I knew inside. And it's hard, but it's harder to ignore it. If they were right, I'd agree. But it's them they know, not me. Now there's a way, and I know that I have to go away. I know I have to go.
We're back.
You're listening to Dads on the Air. It's Peter Van Voort with you, and we're about to be joined by Rudy Oswald from Switzerland. Rudy is a licensed social worker who's going to explain to us what happens to separated fathers in Switzerland and how easily they can be separated from their children once one parent is allotted sole custody by the legal system. We're going to try and find out what, if any, differences there are in the way that separation and divorce are dealt with by the Swiss family justice system compared to what happens in the rest of the Western democracies. Rudy's on the line and he joins us now. Rudy Oswald, welcome to Dads on the Air.
Good morning, Peter, down under.
It's really good of you to join us.
Well, I've been looking forward for this interview as you had been announcing it. And now, just go ahead with the questions, which you obviously have.
Yes, yes. Now, let's start by talking a little bit about your own situation. Rudy, you were once living in a luxury home with your ex and your three young children, but for the last 10 years you've been living out of the back of a van. Could you perhaps briefly explain how that all came about for you?
Well, I usually have to call that story almost unbelievable, as I see people can't understand what really happened to me. Believe it or not, my wife, who is a doctor, she put me under tranquilizers, which made me obviously quite another person. I couldn't defend myself, and those under the influence of those pills, She started threatening me, she started beating me. And finally she asked the court that I should be thrown out of the house. Since, you know, in Switzerland, women do not have to prove that they are feeling threatened. Well, they just have to pretend it. So I was actually thrown out of my own house, and believe it or not, the 1st of November, 10 years ago, exactly.
And she's still in the house, Rudy?
My wife is still living in the house, which we do own at equal parts, so 50-50. 50% of the house belongs to me.
And what about your children?
I have lost complete contact with my children. Just only 4 days ago, my eldest son called me, so since I know that they're still alive.
So you had heard nothing from them for 10 years?
Once in a while, I had a contact with my eldest son. Something like 8 years ago, I had seen them all together for something like 2 minutes.
Wow.
And never in the meantime again.
That's appalling, isn't it? That's appalling. Did you go to court at all, Rudy?
Well, I wrote the court. I've never been to the court, which is a difference. I had a lawyer something 6 years ago, but he gave up working for me after my wife, who was supposed to be for the lawyer, that's Swiss law, didn't pay anymore. And tried to get a lawyer in this country without money. It's probably the same as everywhere. No money, no lawyer.
And you're living in the back of a van. How do you manage that in Switzerland with the cold weather?
It's a good question. The temperatures are just now going down to the freezing point. I hardly know how to survive. I haven't got any resources anymore. Do not know how to survive. When I still had some money in the last winters, I went down to southern Spain. And when it became so cold down there, I even went over to Morocco, as tens of thousands of other Europeans are doing it in winter time. So this winter, I don't have the slightest clue how to survive.
And do you get any government help, like a social pension or anything?
I was entitled, I am still entitled to have it, but they cut that off 3 years ago. I do not know why. I wrote them, I complained many times, and that's now the real point of the story. I do not ever get any answers anymore if I write to any authorities in Switzerland, neither to courts, neither to administrative offices, but nobody that I write, from nobody that I write, I do get any answers.
And why is that, do you think? Don't they have to answer your questions if you put them in writing?
Yeah, sure, they should have to, but they don't. You better ask them why they do not,
yes.
If I may mention that.
Yes, that's
but
true.
The reason is obvious, you know. When I was thrown out of my house, I realized that I had become a victim of my own wife. She had been beating me, she had been threatening me, she had been calling me words, and so on. I opened up a website, which was now almost 10 years ago, and the consequences were very harsh. The Swiss authorities do ignore me since then completely, and as I said, they deny access to all resources, and as I said, including food, housing and legal advice. They threaten me permanently. I still get letters telling me this and that, which I can't follow because I don't have the resources. I become the victim, and in sociological language, I'm re-victimized now. But the hardest to endure is actually the fact that I'm separated from my three young children for now 10 long years.
And is that a typical case, Rudy, in Switzerland? Is that what fathers face?
Well, I would rather call it untypical. I haven't heard from other fathers. But I have heard from other fathers that engage in assisting other fathers that they encounter problems also. But I can't go into details because they didn't tell me what they had to endure.
Sure. Sure. Can you perhaps tell us some of the statistics of this system? For instance, you have a 7.5 million population?
The population in Switzerland is 7.5. That's correct,
yep.
Including all the foreigners living here.
And what is the failure rate of the marriages in Switzerland?
I was looking up for those figures. I received quite a good amount of information from the Swiss Federal Statistical Bureau. In 2007, 49% of the marriages were divorced.
And how is the custody of the children decided in the courts? How do they decide who the kids go with?
In 60% of the cases, the mother gets custody. Shared custody is not compulsory in this country. It's only granted if both parents ask for it. However, it's granted already to 34% of the couples that divorce.
So how many fathers obtain custody of their children then?
In 2007, there were 745 fathers that got it, or 5%.
Only 5%?
Only 5%. 35% of the custody goes to both. And you'll notice there's 1% missing. That 1% goes to other persons. They're not specified in the statistics.
Oh, okay. Okay. And how's the division of property decided in the courts?
That's usually 50-50 if no other agreements have been taken during marriage.
So a bigger percentage of the property doesn't go to the custodial parent?
It's not. No, that's the Swiss law, 50-50. Usually, as I said, if you have taken other decisions beforehand, those will come.
Right. Right. And how many children are affected by the separation? How many? What's the number?
I looked up that number also, quite interestingly, in a small country like Switzerland. In 2007, 14,651 children out of a total number of divorces of 19,882.
And how many of those lose contact with their non-custodial parent within 2 years?
I was trying to find that figure out. I'm sorry, I can't tell you. The Swiss Federal Statistical Bureau does not keep any records about those figures.
Right. What about fathers' rights groups in Switzerland? Is there many of them? Or
I did an online search myself. I found out that there are 6 of them. 4 of them in the German, or correctly, Alemannic-speaking part of the country. 2 in the French-speaking part. And I didn't find any in the Italian, in the southern-speaking, or in the southern part of Switzerland.
And is there
just to mention that, to my knowledge, I'm the only one that offers professional and free consulting, although that the other ones partly ask for money if you want the services.
And you give free advice?
I do get free advice, that is correct. And I open up, for that purpose, I open up my own website, which is papa-help.ch.
And do you get many people asking for your help? Many fathers ask for your help, Rudy?
I do have quite a number of men. In very seldom cases, mothers also contact me.
Is there much cooperation between the groups nationally and in Europe?
Well, I have to speak for myself first. I'm seldom to never contacted by other groups. When I do contact them, they usually don't reply. This seems to be symptomatic for fathers' groups. Everyone cares for himself, and solidarity amongst men or fathers is still a foreign word. Within Europe, I had very few contacts. They broke up after a while, or I didn't get answers as I wrote them.
It's sad, isn't it? That's something that's experienced all over the world. The fathers' groups just have difficulty in solidarity and uniting nationally and especially internationally. It's something that obviously has to happen in the future, but it hasn't happened yet. Have the fathers' groups had any success at improving conditions for non-custodial parents in Switzerland that you know of?
Well, it seems not so far. Legislation in this country, in Switzerland, is a very slow process. The last changes in law have been done back in the year 2000. Right now, the parliament is working on another change. Compulsory joint custody is expected to come out at the end, but nobody knows when this is going to be.
We're speaking with Rudy Oswald from Switzerland, and we'll go to a short break and come back and learn a bit more about conditions faced by separated dads and their children in his country.
despite alienation, which came like a flood. Set them free, set them free, let it rest, let it be. Give them their rights, so why can't you see? Set them free, set them free, let it rest, let it be. Give them a voice like you and me. As sure as the rising tide will come in, and there's no one on earth who's without sin. As loving fathers for our children we pine, but our spirit's not broken, nor our will in decline. As sure as a peace will be followed by war, and some will be rich, some will be poor. We want to protect our children from harm, but we are prevented and try to stay calm. Set them free, set them free, let it rest, let it be. Give them their rights, so why can't you see? Set them free, set them free, let it rest, let it be. Give them a voice like you and me. As sure as in colors, black is not white, and food we must eat to stay healthy and sprite. We won't turn our back on our children we love, though some days it's hard and the going gets tough. As some will die young and others grow old, some tell their story while others withhold. As fathers we care and will never give up the love of our children, which some try to obstruct. Set them free, set them free, let it rest, let it be. Give them their rights, so why can't you see? Set them free, set them free, let it rest, let it be. Give them a voice like you and me. Set them free, set them free, let it rest, let it be. Give them their rights, so why can't you see? Set them free, set them free, let it rest, let it be. Give them a voice.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
You're listening to Dads on the Air, coming to you live from 2GLF in Sydney, Australia, and worldwide on the web at www.dadsontheair.net. My name is Peter Vandervoort, and my guest is Rudy Oswald from Switzerland. Rudy is a licensed social worker and a father's activist. Rudy, are there many women speaking out in support of fathers?
Oh, thanks, Peter, by the way, for calling me an activist. I'm a professional that cares for separate fathers, and in rare cases for separate mothers, as I mentioned before. Requesting political changes and requesting separated fathers to be victims of emotional abuse, which I do on my website, papa-help.com, doesn't make me an activist yet, I believe.
Okay.
Now, back to your question. Over the last 8 years, since I'm online with my website, papa-help.ch, I had only about half a dozen contacts with women that are in favor of separated fathers. I can't see any women speaking out in support of fathers in public.
No women?
I don't see any women speaking out
right.
in support of fathers in public. No,
right.
I'm sorry.
Right. The issue of child support, which is a pretty volatile issue, it causes a lot of problems, the way child support payments and that are assessed. How are child support issues dealt with in Switzerland?
So you mean actually financial support, right?
Yes, yes.
I can't say because this is not my specialty. But it's positively astonishing me. Fathers almost never ask me questions about child support. They are very definitely and much more interested into having a continuous contact with their children.
Yes, yes, that's the same. That's the same everywhere. But do you have a special agency? A child support agency in Switzerland that chases fathers for child support?
I couldn't say that. To my knowledge, there isn't any. I'm sorry.
Okay. So if a father doesn't pay his child support, what happens?
Well, the law says he has to go to jail.
Oh, so you do jail?
And he usually gets a sentence.
Right. So that's similar to America and Canada and Spain and places like that. Yeah. What's the general community's view of the way the family courts handle the issue of separated families?
There are no specialized family courts in this country.
Oh, okay.
Every judge is a general practitioner. That's one of the reasons why there are so many inhuman decisions coming out of what I call public lotteries. The reputation of the courts in family affairs is therefore a very poor one.
That's interesting. I think it's similar in Sweden. They don't have family courts either.
I heard that.
Rudy, how's the problem of non-compliance of court orders dealt with by the courts?
One could say almost not at all. Mothers that don't comply with court orders, such as not granting the visiting rights, are not prosecuted. Whereas fathers that don't pay their financial support go straight to jail, as I said before. Do you wonder that there are very few women that get an entry ticket into prisons? My still-to-be wife got one because she didn't pay the support she was supposed to pay me. This is quite surprising for the sexist Swiss court system. But she still doesn't pay. She still hasn't been in jail. Presumably, the same rights for men and women apply in this country. But if it comes to apply the rule, women are continuously privileged.
So your ex-wife has the kids, and what she's supposed to pay you as well?
That is correct. So goes the law.
How is that? So it's a spousal maintenance, is it?
Well, she's actually the one who made the money. She was running her own practice, and I was back home with the children. So in this case, she was supposed to pay me money when she threw me out.
That's the law.
That is the law.
Oh, that's interesting. Does your government make official statistics available on how many non-custodial parents resort to suicide following forced separation from their children?
The Swiss Federal Statistics Bureau doesn't keep records about the reasons for committing suicide. But just to give you an idea, 1,300 to 1,400 suicides per year, or four per day, happen in this country. There is, of course, an estimated number of unreported cases which would have to be added to this figure. The proportion between male and female suicides has come down over the last decades from 6-1 to 6-2.
Right. And is that all suicide for all reasons?
That's for the whole country. That's for all regions. Yeah.
So there's no separation of the reason of separation from their children. They don't know that, or they won't tell you that.
They do not know that. I've been asking this mm-hmm. question, and they say they don't have a record about that.
And what about separating parents making use of false domestic violence accusations in order to separate the other parent from their children? This happens in a lot of cases these days. It's the number one weapon.
I'm familiar with that question, with that fact. Unfortunately, we haven't got any figures from Switzerland, but I know figures from Germany, our neighbouring country, where general conditions are very much like in Switzerland. There, in every third court case, sexual abuse is an issue. However, 95% of those allegations turn out to be fake. That is correct. Wow. 95% are fake.
95%, yes. It's not easy, is it? Rudy, is there much involvement by the health profession in the separation of children from their parents as part of the court process? Are there many health professionals involved in that?
Well, I tried to explain from my own case. My still-to-be wife is a doctor. She uses every possible way to abuse her status. As far as I can say from the many fathers that contact me for support or counselling, doctors have very little to no knowledge about the consequences of separating fathers from their children. After all, this is a sociological or a psychological issue. Doctors haven't studied either. They are all natural scientists.
How is the issue of parental alienation dealt with in your cause? Is it recognised?
It's not officially recognised. The problem here is that family affairs are not dealt with in open sessions. family sessions are secret. So one never really can say what's going on behind those closed doors. My experience from fathers that contact me is that some judges even legal advisors haven't heard of parental alienation yet.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's so obvious, and yet all around the world, they don't want to know.
Everything has been set, but nobody seems to read it.
That's right. That's right. Rudy, finally, what do you see as a possible solution to this epidemic of forcible removing of children from loving, responsible parents?
I believe in education. That's just one of the reasons why I open up my own website. I dare not only invite fathers to contact me. I also inform about the latest developments on the scientific field. However, I wonder up to this day if all my informations are being understood by the people that should understand, judges, lawyers, and politicians. A sudden change would for sure happen if one day a politician or even a judge would be separated from his children against his will. But why invent the wheel over and over again? Applying the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child and applying the Universal Declaration of Human Rights would suffice completely. I mention only Article 16 of the letter. The family is the natural and fundamental group unit of society and is entitled to protection by society and the state. The question is how we could enforce this in case the judges and the politicians don't comply. Here ends my knowledge. If we can't count any more on what we have been told, what a constitutional state is supposed to be, I think we have to become activists anyway. That's it, Peter.
We've got a long way to go, Rudy. Rudy Oswald, you've been a fascinating guest, and I've really enjoyed speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us on Dads on the Air today and letting the world know what conditions are like for the fathers of Switzerland when they suddenly find themselves separated from their much-loved children. We wish you well and hope that you'll join us again in the future.
Thank you, Peter. And good luck to all those fathers out there that had been listening to the both of us today.
Thank you, Rudy.
And that was Peter van der Voort with the interview with Rudy Oswald there. Thanks to Rock and Pop for that one. And, of course, thanks to Greg Andreessen for the Dr. Arnie Rubenstein speech from the Man Conference. As a final thing here, I've got a flyer in my hand written by Ed Dabrowski. Ed is, of course, a champion of men's issues. He's been on Dads on the Air many times. He also ran for the Shared Parenting Party for Federal Parliament last year. And tomorrow is International Men's Day. So tomorrow, Wednesday, International Men's Day. I'm just going to read a couple of words that Ed Dabrowski has written here. Let me find my spectacles. The human stories, the personal profiles, the journeys of faith and personal discovery, the lessons learned and the wisdoms of our forefathers and our growth as persons all need to be celebrated for all to see. The noble nature of men, their innate human dignity and enormous capacity to love, to be playful as a child and to be Christ-centered in life, love and family. And we need to be empowered to be able to be open and vulnerable and playful and creative and broadcast our authentic selves to the world to appreciate the boy inside us and the grown-up man and the beautiful nature of men and fathers at home, at work, in worship and in service to the world. Those are the words of Ed Dabrowski. We'll be back next week.
We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.